When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Tales of Hearsay by Joseph Conrad. The Warrior's Soul. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Read by Peter Dan. Tales of Hearsay. The Warrior's Soul. 1917. The old officer with long white moustaches gave rein to his indignation. "Is it possible that you youngsters should have no more sense than that? Some of you had better wipe the milk off your upper lip before you start to pass judgment on the few poor stragglers of a generation which has done and suffered not a little in its time." His hearers having expressed much compunction, the ancient warrior became appeased, but he was not silenced. "I am one of them, one of the stragglers, I mean," he went on patiently. "And what did we do? What have we achieved? He, the great Napoleon, started upon us to emulate the Macedonian Alexander with a ruck of nations at his back. We opposed empty spaces to French impetuosity. Then we offered them an interminable battle so that their army went at last to sleep in its positions, lying down on the heaps of its own dead. Then came the Wall of Fire in Moscow. It toppled down on them. Then began the long rout of the Grand Army. I have seen it stream on, like the doomed flight of haggard, spectral sinners across the innermost frozen circle of Dante's Inferno, ever widening before their despairing eyes. They who escaped must have had souls doubly riveted inside their bodies to carry them out of Russia through that frost fit to split rocks. But to say that it was our fault that a single one of them got away is mere ignorance. Why, our own men suffered nearly to the limit of their strength, their Russian strength. Of course our spirit was not broken, and then our cause was good, it was holy, but that did not temper the wind much to men and horses. The flesh is weak, good or evil purpose, humanity has to pay the price. Why, in that very fight for that little village of which I have been telling you, we were fighting for the shelter of those old houses as much as victory. And with the French, it was the same. It wasn't for the sake of glory or for the sake of strategy. The French knew that they would have to retreat before morning, and we knew perfectly well that they would go. As far as the war was concerned, there was nothing to fight about. Yet our infantry and theirs fought like wildcats, or like heroes, if you like that better, amongst the houses. Hot work enough, while the supports out in the open stood freezing in a tempestuous north wind, which drove the snow on earth and the great masses of clouds in the sky at a terrific pace. The very air was inexpressibly sombre by contrast with the white earth. I've never seen God's creation look more sinister than on that day. We, the cavalry, we were only a handful, had not much to do except turn our backs to the wind and receive some stray French round shot. This, I may tell you, was the last of the French guns, and it was the last time they had their artillery in position. Those guns never went away from there, either. We found them abandoned next morning. But that afternoon they were keeping up an infernal fire on our attacking column. The furious wind carried away the smoke and even the noise, but we could see the constant flicker of the tongues of fire along the French front. Then a driving flurry of snow would hide everything except the dark red flashes in the white swirl. At intervals when the line cleared, we could see away across the plain to the right a sombre column moving endlessly, the great rout of the Grand Army creeping on and on all the time, while the fight on our left went on with a great din and fury. The cruel whirlwind of snow swept over that scene of death and desolation. And then the wind fell as suddenly as it had arisen in the morning. Presently we got orders to charge the retreating column. I don't know why, unless they wanted to prevent us from getting frozen in our saddles by giving us something to do. We changed front half right and got into motion at a walk to take that distant dark line in flank. It might have been 2:30 in the afternoon. You must know that so far in this campaign my regiment had never been on the main line of Napoleon's advance. All these months since the invasion, the army we belonged to had been wrestling with Oudinot in the north. We'd only come down lately, driving him before us to the Beresina. This was the first occasion, then, that I and my comrades had a close view of Napoleon's grand army. It was an amazing and terrible sight. I'd heard of it from others. I'd seen the stragglers from it, small bands of marauders, parties of prisoners in the distance. But this was the very column itself, a crawling, stumbling, starved, half-demented mob. It issued from the forest a mile away, and its head was lost in the murk of the fields. We rode into it at a trot, which was the most we could get out of our horses, and we stuck in that human mass as if in a moving bog. There was no resistance. I heard a few shots, half a dozen perhaps. Their very senses seemed frozen within them. I had time for a good look while riding at the head of my squadron. Well, I assure you, there were men walking on the outer edge, so lost to everything but their misery that they never turned their heads to look at our charge. Soldiers. My horse pushed over one of them with his chest. The poor wretch had a dragoon's blue cloak, all torn and scorched, hanging from his shoulders, and he didn't even put his hand out to snatch at my bridle and save himself. He just went down. Our troopers were pointing and slashing. Well, then, of course, at first I myself. What would you have? An enemy's an enemy. Yet a sort of sickening awe crept into my heart. There was no tumult. Only a low, deep murmur dwelt over them, interspersed with louder cries and groans, while that mob kept on pushing and surging past us, sightless and without feeling. A smell of scorched rags and festering wounds hung in the air. My horse staggered in the eddies of swaying men. But it was like cutting down galvanized corpses that didn't care. Invaders, yes. God was already dealing with them. I touched my horse with the spurs to get clear. There was a sudden rush and a sort of angry moan when our second squadron got into them on our right. My horse plunged and somebody got hold of my leg. As I had no mind to get pulled out of the saddle, I gave a backhanded slash without looking. I heard a cry and my leg was let go suddenly. Just then I caught sight of the subaltern of my troop at some little distance from me. His name was Tomasov. That multitude of resurrected bodies with glassy eyes was seething round his horse as if blind, growling crazily. He was sitting erect in his saddle, not looking down at them, and sheathing his sword deliberately. This Tomasov, well, he had a beard. Of course, we all had beards then. Circumstances, lack of leisure, want of razors, too. No, seriously, we were a wild-looking lot in those unforgotten days, which so very many of us did not survive. You know our losses were awful, too. Yes, we looked wild. Des Russes sauvages, what? So, he had a beard, this Tomasov, I mean. But he did not look sauvage. He was the youngest of us all, and that meant real youth. At a distance, he passed muster fairly well, what with the grime and the particular stamp of that campaign on our faces. But directly you were near enough to have a good look into his eyes, that was where his lack of age showed, though he was not exactly a boy. Those same eyes were blue, something like the blue of autumn skies, dreamy and gay, too, innocent, believing eyes. A topknot of fair hair decorated his brow like a gold diadem in what one would call normal times. You may think I am talking of him as if he were the hero of a novel. Why, that's nothing to what the adjutant discovered about him. He discovered that he had a lover's lips, whatever that may be. If the adjutant meant a nice mouth, why, it was nice enough, but of course it was intended for a sneer. That adjutant of ours was not a very delicate fellow. "Look at those lover's lips," he would exclaim in a loud tone while Tomasov was talking. Tomasov didn't quite like that sort of thing, but to a certain extent he had laid himself open to banter by the lasting character of his impressions, which were connected with the passion of love, and perhaps were not of such a rare kind as he seemed to think them. What made his comrades tolerant of his rhapsodies was the fact that they were connected with France, with Paris. You of the present generation, you cannot conceive how much prestige there was then in those names for the whole world. Paris was the centre of wonder for all human beings gifted with imagination. There we were, the majority of us, young and well-connected, but not long out of our hereditary nests in the provinces, simple servants of God, mere rustics, if I may say so. So we were only too ready to listen to the tales of France from our comrade Tomasov. He had been attached to our mission in Paris the year before the war. High protections, very likely, or maybe sheer luck. I don't think he could have been a very useful member of the mission because of his youth and complete inexperience, and apparently all his time in Paris was his own. The use he made of it was to fall in love, to remain in that state, to cultivate it, to exist only for it, in a manner of speaking. Thus it was something more than a mere memory that he had brought with him from France. Memory is a fugitive thing. It can be falsified, it can be effaced, it can even be doubted. Why, I myself came to doubt sometimes that I, too, have been in Paris in my turn, and the long road there with battles for its stages would appear still more incredible if it were not for a certain musket ball which I have been carrying about my person ever since a little cavalry affair which happened in Silesia at the very beginning of the Leipzig campaign. Passages of love, however, are more impressive perhaps than passages of danger. You don't go affronting love in troops, as it were. They are rarer, more personal, and more intimate. And remember that with Tomasov all that was very fresh yet. He had not been home from France 3 months when the war began. His heart, his mind, were full of that experience. He was really awed by it, and he was simple enough to let it appear in his speeches. He considered himself a sort of privileged person, not because a woman had looked at him with favour, but simply because, how shall I say it, he had had the wonderful illumination of his worship for her, as if it were heaven itself that had done this for him. Oh, yes, he was very simple. A nice youngster, yet no fool, and with that, utterly inexperienced, unsuspicious, and unthinking. You'll find one like that here and there in the provinces. He had some poetry in him, too. It could only be natural, something quite his own, not acquired. I suppose Father Adam had some poetry in him of that natural sort. For the rest, un ros sauvage, as the French sometimes called us, but not of that kind which, they maintain, eats tallow candle for a delicacy. As to the woman, the French woman, well, though I have also been in France with 100,000 Russians, I have never seen her. Very likely she was not in Paris then. And in any case, hers were not the doors that would fly open before simple fellows of my sort, you understand. Gilded salons were never in my way. I could not tell you how she looked, which is strange considering that I was, if I may say so, Tomasov's special confidant. He very soon got shy of talking before the others. I suppose the usual campfire comments jarred his fine feelings. But I was left to him, and truly I had to submit. You can't very well expect a youngster in Tomasov's state to hold his tongue altogether, and I suppose you will hardly believe me, I am by nature a rather silent sort of person. Very likely my silence appeared to him sympathetic. All the months of September our regiment, quartered in villages, had come in for an easy time. It was then that I heard most of that, you can't call it a story. The story I have in my mind is not in that. Outpourings, let us call them. I would sit quite content to hold my peace, a whole hour perhaps, while Tomasov talked with exultation. And when he was done, I would still hold my peace. And then there would be produced a solemn effect of silence, which, I imagine, pleased Tomasov in a way. She was, of course, not a woman in her first youth, a widow, maybe. At any rate, I never heard Tomasov mention her husband. She had a salon, something very distinguished, a social centre in which she queened it with great splendour. Somehow, I fancy her court was composed mostly of men. But Tomasov, I must say, kept such details out of his discourse as wonderfully well. Upon my word, I don't know whether her hair was dark or fair, her eyes brown or blue, what was her stature, her features, or her complexion. His love soared above mere physical impressions. He never described it to me in set terms, but he was ready to swear that in her presence everybody's thoughts and feelings were bound to circle round her. She was that sort of woman. Most wonderful conversations on all sorts of subjects went on in her salon, but through them all there flowed unheard, like a mysterious strain of music, the assertion, the power, the tyranny of sheer beauty. So, apparently, the woman was beautiful. She detached all these talking people from their life interests and even from their vanities. She was a secret delight and a secret trouble. All the men, when they looked at her, fell to brooding, as if struck by the thought that their lives had been wasted. She was the very joy and shudder of felicity, and she brought only sadness and torment to the hearts of men. In short, she must have been an extraordinary woman, or else Tomasoff was an extraordinary young fellow to feel in that way and to talk like this about her. I told you the fellow had a lot of poetry in him, and observed that all this sounded true enough. It would be just about the sorcery a woman very much out of the common would exercise, you know. Poets do get close to truth somehow. There is no denying that. There is no poetry in my composition, I know, but I have my share of common shrewdness, and I have no doubt that the lady was kind to the youngster once he did find his way inside her salon. His getting in is the real marvel. However, he did get in, the innocent, and he found himself in distinguished company there, amongst men of considerable position. And you know what that means. Thick waists, bald heads, teeth that are not, as some satirist puts it. Imagine amongst them a nice boy, fresh and simple, like an apple just off the tree. A modest, good-looking, impressionable, adoring young barbarian. My word, what a change. What a relief for jaded feelings. And with that, having in his nature that dose of poetry which saves even a simpleton from being a fool. He became an artlessly, unconditionally devoted slave. He was rewarded by being smiled on, and in time admitted to the intimacy of the house. It may be that the unsophisticated young barbarian amused the exquisite lady. Perhaps, since he didn't feed on tallow candles, he satisfied some need of tenderness in the woman. You know, there are many kinds of tenderness highly civilized women are capable of. Women with heads and imagination, I mean, and no temperament to speak of, you understand. But who is going to fathom their needs or their fancies? Most of the time they themselves don't know much about their innermost moods and blunder out of one into another, sometimes with catastrophic results. And then who is more surprised than they? However, Tomasoff's case was in its nature quite idyllic. The fashionable world was amused. His devotion made for him a kind of social success. But he didn't care. There was his one divinity, and there was the shrine where he was permitted to go in and out without regard for official reception hours. He took advantage of that privilege freely. Well, he had no official duties, you know. The military mission was supposed to be more complimentary than anything else, the head of it being a personal friend of our Emperor Alexander, and he too was laying himself out for successes in fashionable life exclusively, as it seemed. As it seemed. One afternoon, Tomasoff called on the mistress of his thoughts earlier than usual. She was not alone. There was a man with her, not one of the thick-waisted, bald-headed personages, but a somebody all the same, a man over 30, a French officer, who, to some extent, was also a privileged intimate. Tomasoff was not jealous of him. Such a sentiment would have appeared presumptuous to the simple fellow. On the contrary, he admired that officer. You have no idea of the French military men's prestige in those days, even with us Russian soldiers who had managed to face them perhaps better than the rest. Victory had marked them on the forehead, it seemed, forever. They would have been more than human if they had not been conscious of it, but they were good comrades and had a sort of brotherly feeling for all who bore arms, even if it was against them. And this was quite a superior example, an officer of the Major General's staff and a man of the best society besides. He was powerfully built and thoroughly masculine, though he was as carefully groomed as a woman. He had the courteous self-possession of a man of the world. His forehead, white as alabaster, contrasted impressively with the healthy colour of his face. I don't know whether he was jealous of Tomasoff, but I suspect that he might have been a little annoyed at him as at a sort of walking absurdity of the sentimental order. But these men of the world are impenetrable. and outwardly he condescended to recognize Tomasov's existence even more distinctly than was strictly necessary. Once or twice he had offered him some useful worldly advice with perfect tact and delicacy. Tomasov was completely conquered by that evidence of kindness under the cold polish of the best society. Tomasov, introduced into the petit salon, found these two exquisite people sitting on a sofa together, and had the feeling of having interrupted some special conversation. They looked at him strangely, he thought, but he was not given to understand that he had intruded. After a time the lady said to the officer, his name was de Castel, "I wish you would take the trouble to ascertain the exact truth as to that rumour." "It's much more than a mere rumour," remarked the officer. But he got up submissively and went out. The lady turned to Tomasov and said, "You may stay with me." This express command made him supremely happy, though as a matter of fact he had had no idea of going. She regarded him with her kindly glances, which made something glow and expand within his chest. It was a delicious feeling, even though it did cut one's breath short now and then. Ecstatically, he drank in the sound of her tranquil, seductive talk, full of innocent gaiety and of spiritual quietude. His passion appeared to him to flame up and envelop her in blue, fiery tongues from head to foot and over her head, while her soul reposed in the centre like a big white rose. Good this. He told me many other things like that, but this is the one I remember. He himself remembered everything, because these were the last memories of that woman. He was seeing her for the last time, though he did not know it then. Monsieur de Castel returned, breaking into that atmosphere of enchantment Tomasov had been drinking in, even to complete unconsciousness of the external world. Tomasov could not help being struck by the distinction of his movements, the ease of his manner, his superiority to all the other men he knew, and he suffered from it. It occurred to him that these two brilliant beings on the sofa were made for each other. De Castel, sitting down by the side of the lady, murmured to her discreetly, "There is not the slightest doubt that it is true," and they both turned their eyes to Tomasov. Roused thoroughly from his enchantment, he became self-conscious. A feeling of shyness came over him. He sat smiling faintly at them. The lady, without taking her eyes off the blushing Tomasov, said with a dreamy gravity quite unusual to her, "I should like to know that your generosity can be supreme, without a flaw. Love at its highest should be the origin of every perfection." Tomasov opened his eyes wide with admiration at this, as though her lips had been dropping real pearls. The sentiment, however, was not uttered for the primitive Russian youth, but for the exquisitely accomplished man of the world, de Castel. Tomasov could not see the effect it produced, because the French officer lowered his head and sat there contemplating his admirably polished boots. The lady whispered in a sympathetic tone, "You have scruples?" De Castel, without looking up, murmured, "It could be turned into a nice point of honour." She said vivaciously, "That surely is artificial. I am all for natural feelings. I believe in nothing else. But perhaps your conscience..." He interrupted her. "Not at all. My conscience is not childish. The fate of those people is of no military importance to us. What can it matter? The fortune of France is invincible." "Well, then," she uttered meaningly, and rose from the couch. The French officer stood up too. Tomasov hastened to follow their example. He was pained by his state of utter mental darkness. While he was raising the lady's white hand to his lips, he heard the French officer say, with marked emphasis, "If he has the soul of a warrior..." At that time, you know, people really talked in that way. "If he has the soul of a warrior, he ought to fall at your feet in gratitude." Tomasov felt himself plunged into even denser darkness than before. He followed the French officer out of the room and out of the house, for he had a notion that this was expected of him. It was getting dusk, the weather was very bad, and the street was quite deserted. The Frenchman lingered in it strangely, and Tomasov lingered too, without impatience. He was never in a hurry to get away from the house in which she lived. And besides, something wonderful had happened to him. The hand he had reverently raised by the tips of its fingers had been pressed against his lips. He had received a secret favour. He was almost frightened. The world had reeled, and it had hardly steadied itself yet. De Castel stopped short at the corner of the quiet street. "I don't care to be seen too much with you in the lighted thoroughfares, Monsieur Tomasoff," he said in a strangely grim tone. "Why?" asked the young man, too startled to be offended. "From prudence," answered the other curtly. "So we will have to part here. But before we part, I'll disclose to you something of which you will see at once the importance." This, please note, was an evening in late March of the year 1812. For a long time already there had been talk of a growing coolness between Russia and France. The word war was being whispered in drawing-rooms louder and louder, and at last was heard in official circles. Thereupon the Parisian police discovered that our military envoy had corrupted some clerks at the Ministry of War and had obtained from them some very important confidential documents. The wretched men, there were two of them, had confessed their crime and were to be shot that night. Tomorrow all the town would be talking of the affair. But the worst was that the Emperor Napoleon was furiously angry at the discovery and had made up his mind to have the Russian envoy arrested. Such was de Castel's disclosure, and though he had spoken in low tones, Tomasoff was stunned as by a great crash. "Arrested," he murmured desolately. "Yes, and kept as a state prisoner, with everybody belonging to him." The French officer seized Tomasoff's arm above the elbow and pressed it hard. "And kept in France," he repeated into Tomasoff's very ear, and then, letting him go, stepped back a space and remained silent. "And it's you, who are telling me this?" cried Tomasoff, in an extremity of gratitude that was hardly greater than his admiration for the generosity of his future foe. Could a brother have done for him more? He sought to seize the hand of the French officer, but the latter remained wrapped up closely in his cloak. Possibly, in the dark, he had not noticed the attempt. He moved back a bit, and in his self-possessed voice of a man of the world, as though he was speaking across a card table or something of the sort, he called Tomasoff's attention to the fact that if he meant to make use of the warning, the moments were precious. "Indeed, they are," agreed the awed Tomasoff. "Goodbye, then. I have no word of thanks to equal your generosity, but if ever I have an opportunity, I swear it, you may command my life." But the Frenchman retreated, had already vanished in the dark, lonely street. Tomasoff was alone, and then he did not waste any of the precious minutes of that night. See how people's mere gossip and idle talk pass into history. In all the memoirs of the time, if you read them, you will find it stated that our envoy had a warning from some highly placed woman who was in love with him. Of course, it's known that he had successes with women, and in the highest spheres, too, but the truth is that the person who warned him was no other than our simple Tomasoff, an altogether different sort of lover from himself. This, then, is the secret of our Emperor's representative's escape from arrest. He and all his official household got out of France all right, as history records. And amongst that household there was our Tomasoff, of course. He had, in the words of the French officer, the soul of a warrior. And what more desolate prospect for a man with such a soul than to be imprisoned on the eve of war, to be cut off from his country in danger, from his military family, from his duty, from honour, and, well, from glory, too. Tomasoff used to shudder at the mere thought of the moral torture he had escaped, and he nursed in his heart a boundless gratitude to the two people who had saved him from that cruel ordeal. They were wonderful. For him, love and friendship were but two aspects of exalted perfection. He had found these fine examples of it, and he vowed them indeed a sort of cult. It affected his attitude towards Frenchmen in general, great patriot as he was. He was naturally indignant at the invasion of his country, but this indignation had no personal animosity in it. His was fundamentally a fine nature. He grieved at the appalling amount of human suffering he saw around him. Yes, he was in full compassion for all forms of mankind's misery, in a manly way. Less fine natures than his own did not understand this very well. In the regiment they had nicknamed him the Humane Tomasoff. He didn't take offence at it. There is nothing incompatible between humanity and a warrior's soul. People without compassion are the civilians, government officials, merchants, and such like. As to the ferocious talk one hears from a lot of decent people in wartime, Well, the tongue is an unruly member at best, and when there is some excitement going on, there is no curbing its furious activity. So, I had not been very surprised to see Artomasov sheath deliberately his sword right in the middle of that charge, you may say. As we rode away after it, he was very silent. He was not a chatterer, as a rule, but it was evident that this close view of the Grand Army had affected him deeply, like some sight not of this earth. I'd always been a pretty tough individual myself. Well, even I. And there was that fellow with a lot of poetry in his nature. You may imagine what he made of it to himself. We rode side by side without opening our lips. It was simply beyond words. We established our bivouac along the edge of the forest so as to get some shelter for our horses. However, the boisterous north wind had dropped as quickly as it had sprung up, and the great winter stillness lay on the land from the Baltic to the Black Sea. One could almost feel its cold, lifeless immensity reaching up to the stars. Our men had lighted several fires for their officers and had cleared the snow around them. We had big logs of wood for seats. It was a very tolerable bivouac upon the whole, even without the exultation of victory. We were to feel that later, but at present we were oppressed by our stern and arduous task. There were three of us round my fire. The third one was that adjutant. He was perhaps a well-meaning chap, but not so nice as he might have been had he been less rough in manner and less crude in his perceptions. He would reason about people's conduct as though a man were as simple a figure as, say, two sticks laid across each other, whereas a man is much more like the sea, whose movements are too complicated to explain, and whose depths may bring up God only knows what, at any moment. We talked a little about that charge, not much. That sort of thing does not lend itself to conversation. Tomasov muttered a few words about a mere butchery. I had nothing to say. As I told you, I had very soon let my sword hang idle at my wrist. That starving mob had not even tried to defend itself. Just a few shots. We had two men wounded, two, and we had charged the main column of Napoleon's Grand Army. Tomasov muttered wearily. What was the good of it? I did not wish to argue, so I only just mumbled. Ah, well. But the adjutant struck in unpleasantly. Why, it warmed the men a bit. It has made me warm. That's a good enough reason. But our Tomasov is so humane, and besides he has been in love with a French woman, and thick as thieves with a lot of Frenchmen, so he is sorry for them. Never mind, my boy. We are on the Paris road now, and you shall soon see her. This was one of his usual, as we believed them, foolish speeches. None of us but believed that the getting to Paris would be a matter of years, of years. And lo, less than 18 months afterwards, I was rooked of a lot of money in a gambling hell in the Palais Royal. Truth, being often the most senseless thing in the world, is sometimes revealed to fools. I don't think that adjutant of ours believed in his own words. He just wanted to tease Tomasov from habit, purely from habit. We, of course, said nothing, and so he took his head in his hands and fell into a doze as he lay on a log in front of the fire. Our cavalry was on the extreme right wing of the army, and I must confess that we guarded it very badly. We had lost all sense of insecurity by this time, but still we did keep up a pretense of doing it, in a way. Presently a trooper rode up leading a horse, and Tomasov mounted stiffly and went off on a round of the outposts, of the perfectly useless outposts. The night was still, except for the crackling of the fires. The raging wind had lifted far above the earth, and not the faintest breath of it could be heard. Only the full moon swam out with a rush into the sky, and suddenly hung high and motionless overhead. I remember raising my hairy face to it for a moment. Then, I verily believe, I dozed off, too, bent double on my log with my head towards the fierce blaze. You know what an impermanent thing such slumber is. One moment you drop into an abyss, and the next you are back in the world that you would think too deep for any noise but the trumpet of the last judgment, and then off you go again. Your very soul seems to slip down into a bottomless black pit, then up once more into a startled consciousness. A mere plaything of cruel sleep one is then, tormented both ways. However, when my orderly appeared before me, repeating, "Won't your honour be pleased to eat?" "Won't your honour be pleased to eat?" I managed to keep my hold of it, I mean that gaping consciousness. He was offering me a sooty pot containing some grain boiled in water with a pinch of salt. A wooden spoon was stuck in it. At that time, these were the only rations we were getting regularly. Mere chicken food, confound it. But the Russian soldier is wonderful. Well, my fellow waited till I had feasted and then went away, carrying off the empty pot. I was no longer sleepy. Indeed, I had become awake with an exaggerated mental consciousness of existence extending beyond my immediate surroundings. Those are but exceptional moments with mankind, I'm glad to say. I had the intimate sensation of the earth in all its enormous expanse wrapped in snow, with nothing showing on it but trees with their straight stalk-like trunks and their funeral verdure. And in this aspect of general mourning I seemed to hear the sighs of mankind falling to die in the midst of a nature without life. They were Frenchmen. We didn't hate them. They did not hate us. We had existed far apart, and suddenly they had come rolling in with arms in their hand, without fear of God, carrying with them other nations, and all to perish together in a long, long trail of frozen corpses. I had an actual vision of that trail, a pathetic multitude of small, dark mounds stretching away under the moonlight in a clear, still, and pitiless atmosphere, a sort of horrible peace. But what other peace could there be for them? What else did they deserve? I don't know by what connection of emotions there came into my head the thought that the earth was a pagan planet and not a fit abode for Christian virtues. You may be surprised that I should remember all this so well. What is a passing emotion or half-formed thought to last in so many years of a man's changing, inconsequential life? But what has fixed the emotion of that evening in my recollection so that the slightest shadows remain indelible was an event of strange finality, an event not likely to be forgotten in a lifetime, as you shall see. I don't suppose I had been entertaining those thoughts more than 5 minutes when something induced me to look over my shoulder. I can't think it was a noise. The snow deadened all the sounds. Something it must have been, some sort of signal reaching my consciousness. Anyway, I turned my head, and there was the event approaching me, not that I knew it or had the slightest premonition. All I saw in the distance were two figures approaching in the moonlight. One of them was our Tomasov. The dark mass behind him which moved across my sight were the horses which his orderly was leading away. Tomasov was a very familiar appearance, in long boots, a tall figure ending in a pointed hood. But by his side advanced another figure. I mistrusted my eyes at first. It was amazing. It had a shining, crested helmet on its head and was muffled up in a white cloak. The cloak was not as white as snow, nothing in the world is. It was white, more like mist, with an aspect that was ghostly and martial to an extraordinary degree. It was as if Tomasov had got hold of the god of war himself. I could see at once that he was leading this resplendent vision by the arm. Then I saw that he was holding it up. While I stared and stared, they crept on, for indeed they were creeping, and at last they crept into the light of our bivouac fire and passed beyond the log I was sitting on. The blaze played on the helmet. It was extremely battered, and the frost-bitten face, full of sores under it, was framed in bits of mangy fur. No god of war this, but a French officer. The great white cuirassier's cloak was torn, burnt full of holes. His feet were wrapped up in old sheepskins over remnants of boots. They looked monstrous, and he tottered on them, sustained by Tomasov, who lowered him most carefully onto the log on which I sat. My amazement knew no bounds. "You brought in a prisoner," I said to Tomasov, as if I could not believe my eyes. "You must understand that unless they surrendered in large bodies, we made no prisoners. What would have been the good? Our Cossacks either killed the stragglers or else let them alone, just as it happened. It came, really, to the same thing in the end." Tomasov turned to me with a very troubled look. He sprang up from the ground somewhere as I was leaving the outpost, he said. I believe he was making for it, for he walked blindly into my horse. He got hold of my leg, and of course none of our chaps dared touch him then. He had a narrow escape, I said. He didn't appreciate it, said Tomasov, looking even more troubled than before. He came along holding to my stirrup leather. That's what made me so late. He told me he was a staff officer, and then talking in a voice such, I suppose, as the damned alone use, a croaking of rage and pain, he said he had a favour to beg of me, a supreme favour. Did I understand him, he asked, in a sort of fiendish whisper. Of course, I told him that I did. I said, oui, je vous comprends. Then he said, do it, now, at once, in the pity of your heart. Tomasov ceased and stared queerly at me above the head of the prisoner. I said, what did he mean? That's what I asked him, answered Tomasov in a dazed tone, and he said that he wanted me to do him the favour to blow his brains out. As a fellow soldier, he said, as a man of feeling, as a humane man. The prisoner sat between us like an awful gashed mummy as to the face, a martial scarecrow, a grotesque horror of rags and dirt, with awful living eyes, full of vitality, full of unquenchable fire, in a body of horrible affliction, a skeleton at the feast of glory. And suddenly those shining, unextinguishable eyes of his became fixed upon Tomasov. He, poor fellow, fascinated, returned the ghastly stare of a suffering soul in that mere husk of a man. The prisoner croaked at him in French. I recognize you, you know. You are her Russian youngster. You are very grateful. I call on you to pay the debt. Pay it, I say, with one liberating shot. You are a man of honor. I have not even a broken saber. All my being recoils from my own degradation. You know me. Tomasov said nothing. "Haven't you got the soul of a warrior?" the Frenchman asked in an angry whisper, but with something of a mocking intention in it. "I don't know," said poor Tomasov. What a look of contempt that scarecrow gave him out of his unquenchable eyes. He seemed to live only by the force of infuriated and impotent despair. Suddenly he gave a gasp and fell forward, writhing in the agony of cramp in all his limbs, a not unusual effect of the heat of a campfire. It resembled the application of some horrible torture. But he tried to fight against the pain at first. He only moaned low while we bent over him so as to prevent him rolling into the fire, and muttered feverishly at intervals, "Tuez-moi! Tuez-moi!" till, vanquished by the pain, he screamed in agony time after time, each cry bursting out through his compressed lips. The adjutant woke up on the other side of the fire and started swearing awfully at the beastly row that Frenchman was making. "What's this? More of your infernal humanity, Tomasov?" he yelled at us. "Why don't you have him thrown out of this to the devil on the snow?" As we paid no attention to his shouts, he got up, cursing, shockingly, and went away to another fire. Presently the French officer became easier. We propped him against the log and sat silent on each side of him till the bugles started their call at the first break of day. The big flames kept up all through the night, paled on the livid sheet of snow, while the frozen air all round rang with the brazen notes of cavalry trumpets. The Frenchman's eyes, fixed in a glassy stare, which for a moment made us hope that he had died quietly sitting there between us two, stirred slowly to right and left, looking at each of our faces in turn. Tomasov and I exchanged glances of dismay. Then de Castel's voice, unexpected in its renewed strength and ghastly self-possession, made us shudder inwardly. "Bonjour, monsieur." His chin dropped on his breast. Tomasov addressed me in Russian. "It is he, the man himself." I nodded, and Tomasov went on in a tone of anguish. "Yes, he. Brilliant, accomplished. Envied by men, loved by that woman. This horror, this miserable thing that cannot die. Look at his eyes. It's terrible." I did not look, but I understood what Tomasov meant. We could do nothing for him. This avenging winter of fate held both the fugitives and the pursuers in its iron grip. Compassion was but a vain word before that unrelenting destiny. I tried to say something about a convoy being no doubt collected in the village, but I faltered at the mute glance Tomasov gave me. We knew what those convoys were like, appalling mobs of hopeless wretches driven on by the butts of Cossacks' lances back to the frozen inferno, with their faces set away from their homes. Our two squadrons had been formed along the edge of the forest. The minutes of anguish were passing. The Frenchman suddenly struggled to his feet. We helped him, almost without knowing what we were doing. "Come," he said in measured tones. "This is the moment." He paused for a long time, then with the same distinctness went on, "On my word of honour, all faith is dead in me." His voice lost suddenly its self-possession. After waiting a little while, he added in a murmur, "And even my courage, upon my honour." Another long pause ensued before, with a great effort, he whispered hoarsely, "Isn't this enough to move a heart of stone? Am I to go on my knees to you?" Again a deep silence fell upon the three of us. Then the French officer flung his last word of anger at Tomasov, "Milksop!" Not a feature of the poor fellow moved. I made up my mind to go and fetch a couple of our troopers to lead that miserable prisoner away to the village. There was nothing else for it. I had not moved 6 paces towards the group of horses and orderlies in front of our squadron when... But you have guessed it. Of course. And I guessed it, for I give you my word that the report of Tomasov's pistol was the most insignificant thing imaginable. The snow certainly does absorb sound. It was a mere feeble pop. Of the orderlies holding our horses, I don't think one turned his head round. Yes, Tomasov had done it. Destiny had led that de Castel to the man who could understand him perfectly. But it was poor Tomasov's lot to be the predestined victim. You know what the world's justice and mankind's judgment are like. They fell heavily on him with a sort of inverted hypocrisy. Why, that brute of an adjutant himself was the first to set going horrified allusions to the shooting of a prisoner in cold blood. Tomasov was not dismissed from the service, of course, but after the siege of Danzig he asked for permission to resign from the army and went away to bury himself in the depths of his province, where a vague story of some dark deed clung to him for years. Yes, he had done it. And what was it? One warrior's soul paying its debt 100-fold to another warrior's soul by releasing it from a fate worse than death, the loss of all faith and courage. You may look on it in that way. I don't know. And perhaps poor Tomasov did not know himself. But I was the first to approach that appalling dark group on the snow, the Frenchman extended rigidly on his back, Tomasov kneeling on one knee, rather nearer to the feet than to the Frenchman's head. He had taken his cap off, and his hair shone like gold in the light drift of flakes that had begun to fall. He was stooping over the dead in a tenderly contemplative attitude, and his young, ingenuous face, with lowered eyelids, expressed no grief, no sternness, no horror, but was set in the repose of a profound, as if endless and endlessly silent, meditation. End of The Warrior's Soul, 1917. Prince Roman, in Tales of Hearsay, by Joseph Conrad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Peter Dan. Prince Roman, 1911. Events which happened 70 years ago are perhaps rather too far off to be dragged aptly into a mere conversation. Of course, the year 1831 is for us an historical date, one of these fatal years which, in the presence of the world's passive indignation and eloquent sympathies, we had once more to murmur, "Woe victis," and count the cost in sorrow. Not that we were ever very good at calculating, either, in prosperity or in adversity. That's a lesson we could never learn, to the great exasperation of our enemies, who have bestowed upon us the epithet of incorrigible. The speaker was of Polish nationality, that nationality not so much alive as surviving, which persists in thinking, breathing, speaking, hoping, and suffering in its grave, railed in by a million of bayonets and triple-sealed with the seals of 3 great empires. The conversation was about aristocracy. How did this, nowadays discredited subject, come up? It is some years ago now, and the precise recollection has faded, but I remember that it was not considered practically as an ingredient in the social mixture, and I verily believed that we arrived at that subject through some exchange of ideas about patriotism, a somewhat discredited sentiment, because the delicacy of our humanitarians regarded it as a relic of barbarianism. Yet neither the great Florentine painter who closed his eyes in death thinking of his city, nor St. Francis blessing with his last breath the town of Assisi, were barbarians. It requires a certain greatness of soul to interpret patriotism worthily, or else a sincerity of feeling denied to the vulgar refinement of modern thought, which cannot understand the august simplicity of a sentiment proceeding from the very nature of things and men. The aristocracy we were talking about was the very highest. The great families of Europe, not impoverished, not converted, not liberalized, the most distinctive and specialized class of all classes, for which even ambition itself does not exist among the usual incentives to activity and regulators of conduct. The undisputed right of leadership having passed away from them, we judge that their great fortunes, their cosmopolitanism brought about by wide alliances, their elevated station, in which there is so little to gain and so much to lose, must make their position difficult in times of political commotion or national upheaval. No longer born to command, which is the very essence of aristocracy, it becomes difficult for them to do aught else but hold aloof from the great movements of popular passion. We had reached that conclusion when the remark about far-off events was made, and the date of 1831 mentioned. And the speaker continued. I don't mean to say that I knew Prince Roman at that remote time. I begin to feel pretty ancient, but I'm not so ancient as that. In fact, Prince Roman was married the very year my father was born. It was in 1828. The 19th century was young yet, and the prince was even younger than the century, but I don't know exactly by how much. In any case, his was an early marriage. It was an ideal alliance from every point of view. The girl was young and beautiful, an orphan heiress of a great name and of a great fortune. The prince, then an officer in the guards, and distinguished amongst his fellows by something reserved and reflective in his character, had fallen headlong in love with her beauty, her charm, and the serious qualities of her mind and heart. He was a rather silent young man, but his glances, his bearing, his whole person expressed his absolute devotion to the woman of his choice, a devotion which she returned in her own frank and fascinating manner. The flame of this pure young passion promised to burn forever, and for a season it lit up the dry, cynical atmosphere of the great world of St. Petersburg. The Emperor Nicholas himself, the grandfather of the present man, the one who died from the Crimean War, the last perhaps of the autocrats with a mystical belief in the divine character of his mission, showed some interest in this pair of married lovers. It is true that Nicholas kept a watchful eye on all the doings of the great Polish nobles. The young people, leading a life appropriate to their station, were obviously wrapped up in each other, and society, fascinated by the sincerity of a feeling moving serenely among the artificialities of its anxious and fastidious agitation, watched them with benevolent indulgence and an amused tenderness. The marriage was the social event of 1828 in the capital. Just 40 years afterwards, I was staying in the country house of my mother's brother in our southern provinces. It was the dead of winter. The great lawn in front was as pure and smooth as an alpine snowfield, a white and feathery level sparkling under the sun, as if sprinkled with diamond dust, declining gently to the lake, a long, sinuous piece of frozen water, looking bluish and more solid than the earth. A cold, brilliant sun glided low above an undulating horizon of great folds of snow, in which the villages of Ukrainian peasants remained out of sight, like clusters of boats hidden in the hollows of a running sea, and everything was very still. I don't know now how I managed to escape at 11 o'clock in the morning from the schoolroom. I was a boy of 8. The little girl, my cousin, a few months younger than myself, though hereditarily more quick-tempered, was less adventurous. So I had escaped alone, and presently I found myself in the great stone-paved hall, warmed by a monumental stove of white tiles, a much more pleasant locality than the schoolroom, which for some reason or other, perhaps hygienic, was always kept at a low temperature. We children were aware that there was a guest staying in the house. He had arrived the night before, just as we were being driven off to bed. We broke back through the line of beaters to rush and flatten our noses against the dark window panes, but we were too late to see him alight. We had only watched in a ruddy glare the big travelling carriage on sleigh runners, harnessed with 6 horses, a black mass against the snow, going off to the stables, preceded by a horseman carrying a blazing ball of tow and resin in an iron basket at the end of a long stick swung from his saddle bow. 2 stable boys had been sent out early in the afternoon along the snow tracks to meet the expected guest at dusk and light his way with these road torches. At that time, you must remember, there was not a single mile of railways in our southern provinces. My little cousin and I had no knowledge of trains and engines except from picture books, as of things rather vague, extremely remote, and not particularly interesting, unless to grown-ups who travelled abroad. Our notion of princes, perhaps a little more precise, was mainly literary, and had a glamour reflected from the light of fairy tales, in which princes always appear young, charming, heroic, and fortunate. Yet, as well as any other children, we could draw a firm line between the real and the ideal. We knew that princes were historical personages, and there was some glamour in that fact, too. But what had driven me to roam cautiously over the house like an escaped prisoner was the hope of snatching an interview with a special friend of mine, the head forester, who generally came to make his report at that time of the day. I yearned for news of a certain wolf. You know, in a country where wolves are to be found, every winter almost brings forward an individual eminent by the audacity of his misdeeds, by his more perfect wolfishness, so to speak. I wanted to hear some new thrilling tale of that wolf, perhaps the dramatic story of his death. But there was no one in the hall. Deceived in my hopes, I became suddenly very much depressed. Unable to slip back in triumph to my studies, I elected to stroll spiritlessly into the billiard room, where certainly I had no business. There was no one there either, and I felt very lost and desolate under its high ceiling, all alone with the massive English billiard table, which seemed in heavy, rectilinear silence to disapprove of that small boy's intrusion. As I began to think of retreat, I heard footsteps in the adjoining drawing-room, and before I could turn tail and flee, my uncle and his guest appeared in the doorway. To run away after having been seen would have been highly improper, so I stood my ground. My uncle looked surprised to see me. The guest by his side was a spare man, of average stature, buttoned up in a black frock-coat and holding himself very erect, with a stiffly soldier-like carriage. From the folds of a soft white cambric neckcloth peeped the points of a collar close against each shaven cheek. A few wisps of thin grey hair were brushed smoothly across the top of his bald head. His face, which must have been beautiful in its day, had preserved in age the harmonious simplicity of its lines. What amazed me was its even, almost death-like pallor. He seemed to me to be prodigiously old. A faint smile, a mere momentary alteration in the set of his thin lips, acknowledged my blushing confusion, and I became greatly interested to see him reach into the inside breast pocket of his coat. He extracted therefrom a lead pencil and a block of detachable pages, which he handed to my uncle with an almost imperceptible bow. I was very much astonished, but my uncle received it as a matter of course. He wrote something at which the other glanced and nodded slightly. A thin, wrinkled hand, the hand was older than the face, patted my cheek and then rested on my head lightly. An unringing voice, a voice as colourless as the face itself, issued from his sunken lips, while the eyes, dark and still, looked down at me kindly. "And how old is this shy little boy?" Before I could answer, my uncle wrote down my age on the pad. I was deeply impressed. What was this ceremony? Was this personage too great to be spoken to? Again he glanced at the pad, and again gave a nod. And again that impersonal, mechanical voice was heard. "He resembles his grandfather." I remembered my paternal grandfather. He had died not long before. He, too, was prodigiously old, and to me it seemed perfectly natural that 2 such ancient and venerable persons should have known each other in the dim ages of creation before my birth. But my uncle obviously had not been aware of the fact, so obviously that the mechanical voice explained, Yes, comrades in 31. He was one of those who knew. Old times, my dear sir, old times. He made a gesture as if to put aside an importunate ghost, and now they were both looking down at me. I wondered whether anything was expected from me. To my round, questioning eyes, my uncle remarked, "He's completely deaf," and the unrelated, inexpressive voice said, "Give me your hand." Acutely conscious of inky fingers, I put it out timidly. I had never seen a deaf person before, and was rather startled. He pressed it firmly, and then gave me a final pat on the head. My uncle addressed me weightily. "You have shaken hands with Prince Roman, S. It's something for you to remember when you grow up." I was impressed by his tone. I had enough historical information to know vaguely that the Princess S counted amongst the sovereign princes of Ruthenia until the union of all Ruthenian lands to the Kingdom of Poland, when they became great Polish magnates, sometime at the beginning of the 15th century. But what concerned me most was the failure of the fairy tale glamour. It was shocking to discover a prince who was deaf, bald, meagre, and so prodigiously old. It never occurred to me that this imposing and disappointing man had been young, rich, beautiful. I could not know that he had been happy in the felicity of an ideal marriage, uniting two young hearts, two great names, and two great fortunes, happy with a happiness which, as in fairy tales, seemed destined to last forever. But it did not last forever. It was fated not to last very long, even by the measure of the days allotted to men's passage on this earth, where enduring happiness is only found in the conclusion of fairy tales. A daughter was born to them, and shortly afterwards the health of the young princess began to fail. For a time she bore up with smiling intrepidity, sustained by the feeling that now her existence was necessary for the happiness of two lives. But at last the husband, thoroughly alarmed by the rapid changes in her appearance, obtained an unlimited leave, and took her away from the capital to his parents in the country. The old prince and princess were extremely frightened at the state of their beloved daughter-in-law. Preparations were at once made for a journey abroad, but it seems as if it were already too late, and the invalid herself opposed the project with gentle obstinacy. Thin and pale in the great armchair, where the insidious and obscure nervous malady made her appear smaller and more frail every day, without effacing the smile of her eyes or the charming grace of her wasted face, she clung to her native land and wished to breathe her native air. Nowhere else could she expect to get well so quickly. Nowhere else would it be so easy for her to die. She died before her little girl was 2 years old. The grief of the husband was terrible, and the more alarming to his parents because perfectly silent and dry-eyed. After the funeral, while the immense bare-headed crowd of peasants surrounding the private chapel on the grounds was dispersing, the prince, waving away his friends and relations, remained alone to watch the masons of the estate closing the family vault. When the last stone was in position, he uttered a groan, the first sound of pain which had escaped him for days, and walking away with lowered head, shut himself up again in his apartments. His father and mother feared for his reason. His outward tranquillity was appalling to them. They had nothing to trust to but that very youth which made his despair so self-absorbed and so intense. Old Prince John, fretful and anxious, repeated, "Poor Roman should be roused somehow, he's so young." But they could find nothing to rouse him with. And the old princess, wiping her eyes, wished in her heart he were young enough to come and cry at her knee. In time, Prince Roman, making an effort, would join now and again the family circle, but it was as if his heart and his mind had been buried in the family vault with the wife he had lost. He took to wandering in the woods with a gun, watched over secretly by one of the keepers, who would report in the evening that "His Serenity has never fired a shot all day." Sometimes, walking to the stables in the morning, he would order, in subdued tones, a horse to be saddled, wait, switching his boot till it was led up to him, then mount without a word and ride out of the gates at a walking pace. He would be gone all day. People saw him on the roads, looking neither to the right nor to the left, white-faced, sitting rigidly in the saddle like a horseman of stone on a living mount. The peasants working in the fields, the great unhedged fields, looked after him from the distance, and sometimes some sympathetic old woman on the threshold of a low thatched hut was moved to make the sign of the cross in the air behind his back, as though he were one of themselves, a simple village soul struck by a sore affliction. He rode looking straight ahead, seeing no one, as if the earth were empty and all mankind buried in that grave which had opened so suddenly in his path to swallow up his happiness. What were men to him with their sorrows, joys, labours and passions, from which she who had been all the world to him had been cut off so early? They did not exist, and he would have felt as completely lonely and abandoned as a man in the toils of a cruel nightmare if it had not been for this countryside where he had been born and had spent his happy boyish years. He knew it well, every slight rise crowned with trees amongst the ploughed fields, every dell concealing a village. The dammed streams made a chain of lakes set in the green meadows. Far away to the north, the great Lithuanian forest faced the sun, no higher than a hedge, and to the south, the way to the plains, the vast brown spaces of the earth touched the blue sky. And this familiar landscape, associated with the days without thought and without sorrow, this land, the charm of which he felt without even looking at it, soothed his pain like the presence of an old friend who sits silent and disregarded by one in some dark hour of life. One afternoon it happened that the prince, after turning his horse's head for home, remarked a low dense cloud of dark dust cutting off slantwise a part of the view. He reined in on a knoll and peered. There were slender gleams of steel here and there in that cloud, and it contained moving forms which revealed themselves at last as a long line of peasant carts full of soldiers moving slowly in double file under the escort of mounted Cossacks. It was like an immense reptile creeping over the fields. Its head dipped out of sight in a slight hollow, and its tail went on writhing and growing shorter, as though the monster were eating its way slowly into the very heart of the land. The prince directed his way through a village lying a little off the track. The roadside inn, with its stable, byre, and barn under one enormous thatched roof, resembled a deformed, hunchbacked, ragged giant sprawling amongst the small huts of the peasants. The innkeeper, a portly, dignified Jew, clad in a black satin coat reaching down to his heels and girt with a red sash, stood at the door stroking his long, silvery beard. He watched the prince approach and bowed gravely from the waist, not expecting to be noticed even, since it was well known that their young lord had no eyes for anything or anybody in his grief. It was quite a shock for him when the prince pulled up and asked, "What's all this, Yankel?" "That is, please your serenity, that is a convoy of foot soldiers they are hurrying down to the south." He glanced right and left cautiously, but as there was no one near but some children playing in the dust of the village street, he came up close to the stirrup. "Doesn't your serenity know? It has begun already down there. All the landowners, great and small, are out in arms, and even the common people have risen. Only yesterday the saddler from Grodek, it was a tiny mountain town nearby, went through here with his two apprentices on his way to join. He left even his cart with me. I gave him a guide through our neighbourhood. You know, your serenity, our people, they travel a lot, and they see all that's going on, and they know all the roads." He tried to keep down his excitement, for the Jew, Yankel, innkeeper and tenant of all the mills on the estate, was a Polish patriot, and in a still lower voice, "I was already a married man when the French and all the other nations passed this way with Napoleon. That was a great harvest for death, knew? Perhaps this time God will help." The prince nodded, "Perhaps," and falling into deep meditation, he let his horse take him home. That night he wrote a letter, and early in the morning sent a mounted express to the post town. During the day he came out of his taciturnity to the great joy of the family circle, and conversed with his father of recent events, the revolt in Warsaw, the flight of the Grand Duke Constantine, the first slight successes of the Polish army, at that time there was a Polish army, the risings in the provinces. Old Prince John, moved and uneasy, speaking from a purely aristocratic point of view, mistrusted the popular origins of the movement, regretted its democratic tendencies, and did not believe in the possibility of success. He was sad, inwardly agitated. "I am judging all this calmly. There are secular principles of legitimacy and order which have been violated in this reckless enterprise for the sake of the most subversive illusions, though, of course, the patriotic impulses of the heart..." Prince Roman had listened in a thoughtful attitude. He took advantage of the pause to tell his father quietly that he had sent that morning a letter to St. Petersburg, resigning his commission in the Guards. The old prince remained silent. He thought that he ought to have been consulted. His son was also ordnance officer to the Emperor, and he knew that the Tsar would never forget this appearance of defection in a Polish noble. In a discontented tone, he pointed out to his son that, as it was, he had an unlimited leave. The right thing would have been to keep quiet. They had too much tact at court to recall a man of his name, or at worst some distant mission might have been asked for, to the Caucasus, for instance, away from this unhappy struggle, which was wrong in principle, and therefore destined to fail. "Presently you shall find yourself without any interest in life and with no occupation, and you shall need something to occupy you, my poor boy. You have acted rashly, I fear." Prince Roman murmured, "I thought it better." His father faltered under his steady gaze. "Well, well, perhaps, but as ordnance officer to the Emperor and in favour with all the imperial family." "Those people had never been heard of when our house was already illustrious," the young man let fall disdainfully. This was the sort of remark to which the old prince was sensible. "Well, perhaps it is better," he conceded at last. The father and son parted affectionately for the night. The next day Prince Roman seemed to have fallen back into the depths of his indifference. He rode out as usual. He remembered that the day before he had seen a reptile-like convoy of soldiery, bristling with bayonets, crawling over the face of that land which was his. The woman he loved had been his too. Death had robbed him of her. Her loss had been to him a moral shock. It had opened his heart to a greater sorrow, his mind to a vaster thought, his eyes to all the past and to the existence of another love, fraught with pain, but as mysteriously as imperative as that lost one to which he had entrusted his happiness. That evening he retired earlier than usual and rang for his personal servant. "Go and see if there is light yet in the quarters of the Master of the Horse. If he is still up, ask him to come and speak to me." While the servant was absent on this errand, the prince tore up hastily some papers, locked the drawers of his desk, and hung a medallion containing the miniature of his wife round his neck against his breast. The man the prince was expecting belonged to that past which the death of his love had called to life. He was of a family of small nobles who for generations had been adherents, servants, and friends of the Princess S. He remembered the times before the last partition and had taken part in the struggles of the last hour. He was a typical old Pole of that class, with a great capacity for emotion, for blind enthusiasm, with martial instincts and simple beliefs, and even with the old-time habit of larding his speech with Latin words. And his kindly, shrewd eyes, his ruddy face, his lofty brow, and his thick grey, pendant moustache were also very typical of his kind. "Listen, Master Francis," the prince said familiarly and without preliminaries. "Listen, old friend, I'm going to vanish from here quietly. I go where something louder than my grief and yet something with a voice very like it calls me. I confide in you alone. You will say what's necessary when the time comes." The old man understood. His extended hands trembled exceedingly. But as soon as he found his voice, he thanked God aloud for letting him live long enough to see the descendant of the illustrious family in its youngest generation give an example, coram gentibus, of the love of his country and of valour in the field. He doubted not of his dear prince attaining a place in council and in war worthy of his high birth. He saw already that, in full glory of family glory, a fulget patride serenitas. At the end of the speech he burst into tears and fell into the prince's arms. The prince quieted the old man, and when he had him seated in an armchair and comparatively composed, he said, "Don't misunderstand me, Master Francis. You know how I loved my wife. A loss like that opens one's eyes to unsuspected truths. There is no question here of leadership and glory. I mean to go alone and to fight obscurely in the ranks. I am going to offer my country what is mine to offer, that is, my life, as simply as the saddler from Grodeck who went through yesterday with his apprentices." The old man cried out at this. That could never be. He could not allow it. But he had to give way before the arguments and the express will of the prince. "Ah, if you say that it is a matter of feeling and conscience, so be it. But you cannot go utterly alone. Alas, that I am too old to be of any use. Crepit verba dolor, my dear prince, at the thought that I am over 70 and of no more account in the world than a cripple in the church porch. It seems that to sit at home and pray to God for the nation and for you is all I am fit for. But there is my son, my youngest son, Peter. He will make a worthy companion for you. And as it happens, he's staying with me here. There has not been for ages a Prince S hazarding his life without a companion of our name to ride by his side. You must have by you somebody who knows who you are, if only to let your parents and your old servant hear what is happening to you. And when does your princely mightiness mean to start?" "In an hour," said the prince, and the old man hurried off to warn his son. Prince Roman took up a candlestick and walked quietly along a dark corridor in the silent house. The head nurse said afterwards that, waking up suddenly, she saw the prince looking at his child, one hand shading the light from its eyes. He stood and gazed at her for some time, and then, putting the candlestick on the floor, bent over the cot and kissed lightly the little girl, who did not wake. He went out noiselessly, taking the light away with him. She saw his face perfectly well, but she could read nothing of his purpose in it. It was pale, but perfectly calm, and after he turned away from the cot, he never looked back at it once. The only other trusted person, besides the old man and his son Peter, was the Jew Yankel. When he asked the prince where precisely he wanted to be guided, the prince answered, "To the nearest party." A grandson of the Jew, a lanky youth, conducted the two young men by little-known paths across woods and morasses, and led them in sight of the few fires of a small detachment camped in a hollow. Some invisible horses neighed. A voice in the dark cried, "Who goes there?" And the young Jew departed hurriedly, explaining that he must make haste home to be in time for keeping the Sabbath. Thus, humbly, and in accord with the simplicity of the vision of duty he saw, where death had removed the brilliant bandage of happiness from his eyes, did Prince Roman bring his offering to his country. His companion made himself known as the son of the Master of the Horse to Princess S, and declared him to be a relation, a distant cousin from the same parts as himself, and, as people presumed, of the same name. In truth, no one inquired much. Two more young men, clearly of the right sort, had joined. Nothing more natural. Prince Roman did not remain long in the south. One day, while scouting with several others, they were ambushed near the entrance of a village by some Russian infantry. The first discharge laid low a good many, and the rest scattered in all directions. The Russians, too, did not stay, being afraid of a return in force. After some time, the peasants, coming to view the scene, extricated Prince Roman from under his dead horse. He was unhurt, but his faithful companion had been one of the first to fall. The prince helped the peasants to bury him and the other dead. Then, alone, not certain where to find the body of partisans which was constantly moving about in all directions, he resolved to try and join the main Polish army facing the Russians on the borders of Lithuania. Disguised in peasant clothes in case of meeting some marauding Cossacks, he wandered a couple of weeks before he came upon a village occupied by a regiment of Polish cavalry on outpost duty. On a bench, before a peasant hut of a better sort, sat an elderly officer whom he took for the colonel. The prince approached respectfully, told his story shortly, and stated his desire to enlist, and when asked his name by the officer, who had been looking him over carefully, he gave, on the spur of the moment, the name of his dead companion. The elderly officer thought to himself, "Here's the son of some peasant proprietor of the liberated class." He liked his appearance. "And can you read and write, my good fellow?" he asked. "Yes, Your Honour, I can," said the prince. "Good. Come along inside the hut. The regimental adjutant is there. He will enter your name and administer the oath to you." The adjutant stared very hard at the newcomer, but said nothing. When all the forms had been gone through and the recruit gone out, he turned to his superior officer. "Do you know who that is?"
"Who?"
"That Peter, a likely chap."
"That's Prince Romanes."
"Nonsense."
But the adjutant was positive. He had seen the prince several times, about 2 years before, in the castle in Warsaw. He had even spoken to him once at a reception of officers held by the Grand Duke.
"He's changed. He seems much older, but I am certain of my man. I have a good memory for faces."
The two officers looked at each other in silence.
"He's sure to be recognized sooner or later," murmured the adjutant.
The colonel shrugged his shoulders.
"It's no affair of ours, if he has a fancy to serve in the ranks. As to being recognized, it's not so likely. All our officers and men come from the other end of Poland."
He meditated gravely for a while, then smiled. "He told me he could read and write. There's nothing to prevent me making him a sergeant at the first opportunity. He's sure to shape all right."
Prince Roman, as a non-commissioned officer, surpassed the colonel's expectations. Before long, Sergeant Peter became famous for his resourcefulness and courage. It was not the reckless courage of a desperate man. It was a self-possessed, as if conscientious valour which nothing could dismay, a boundless but equable devotion, unaffected by time, by reverses, by the discouragement of endless retreats, by the bitterness of waning hopes and the horrors of pestilence added to the toils and perils of war. It was in this year that the cholera made its first appearance in Europe. It devastated the camps of both armies, affecting the firmest minds with the terror of a mysterious death stalking silently between the piled-up arms and around the bivouac fires. A sudden shriek would wake up the harassed soldiers, and they would see in the glow of embers one of themselves writhe on the ground like a worm trodden on by an invisible foot, and before the dawn broke he would be stiff and cold. Parties so visited have been known to rise like one man, abandon the fire, and run off into the night in mute panic. Or a comrade talking to you on the march would stammer suddenly in the middle of a sentence, roll affrighted eyes, and fall down with distorted face and blue lips, breaking the ranks with the convulsions of his agony. Men were struck in the saddle, on sentry duty, in the firing line, carrying orders, serving the guns. I have been told that in a battalion forming under fire with perfect steadiness for the assault of a village, 3 cases occurred within 5 minutes at the head of the column, and the attack could not be delivered because the leading companies scattered all over the fields like chaff before the wind. Sergeant Peter, young as he was, had a great influence over his men. It was said that the number of desertions in the squadron in which he served was less than in any other in the whole of that cavalry division. Such was supposed to be the compelling example of one man's quiet intrepidity in facing every form of danger and terror. However that may be, he was liked and trusted generally. When the end came and the remnants of that army corps, hard-pressed on all sides, were preparing to cross the Prussian frontier, Sergeant Peter had enough influence to rally round him a score of troopers. He managed to escape with them at night from the hemmed-in army. He led this band through 200 miles of country, covered by numerous Russian detachments and ravaged by the cholera. But this was not to avoid captivity, to go into hiding and try to save themselves. No, he led them into a fortress which was still occupied by the Poles, and where the last stand of the vanquished revolution was to be made. This looks like mere fanaticism, but fanaticism is human. Man has adored ferocious divinities. There is ferocity in every passion, even in love itself. The religion of undying hope resembles the mad cult of despair, of death, of annihilation. The difference lies in the moral motive springing from the secret needs and the unexpressed aspiration of the believers. It is only to vain men that all is vanity, and all is deception only to those who have never been sincere with themselves. It was in the fortress that my grandfather found himself together with Sergeant Peter. My grandfather was a neighbour of the S family in the country, but he did not know Prince Roman,
who, however, knew his name perfectly well. The prince introduced himself one night as they both sat on the ramparts, leaning against a gun carriage. The service he wished to ask for was, in case of his being killed, to have the intelligence conveyed to his parents. They talked in low tones, the other servants of the peace lying about near them. My grandfather gave the required promise, and then asked frankly, for he was greatly interested by the disclosure so unexpectedly made, "But tell me, Prince, why this request? Have you any evil forebodings as to yourself?" "Not in the least. I was thinking of my people. They have no idea where I am," answered Prince Roman. "I'll engage to do as much for you if you like. It's certain that half of us at least shall be killed before the end, so there's an even chance of one of us surviving the other." My grandfather told him where, as he supposed, his wife and children were then. From that moment till the end of the siege, the two were much together. On the day of the great assault, my grandfather received a severe wound. The town was taken. Next day, the citadel itself, its hospital full of dead and dying, its magazines empty, its defenders having burnt their last cartridge, opened its gates. During all the campaign, the prince, exposing his person conscientiously on every occasion, had not received a scratch. No one had recognized him, or at any rate had betrayed his identity. Till then, as long as he did his duty, it had mattered nothing who he was. Now, however, the position was changed. As ex-guardsman and as late ordnance officer to the emperor, this rebel ran a serious risk of being given special attention in the shape of a firing squad at 10 paces. For more than a month he remained lost in the miserable crowd of prisoners packed in the casemates of the citadel, with just enough food to keep body and soul together, but otherwise allowed to die from wounds, privation, and disease at the rate of 40 or so a day. The position of the fortress being central, new parties, captured in the open in the course of a thorough pacification, were being sent in frequently. Amongst such newcomers there happened to be a young man, a personal friend of the prince from his school days. He recognized him, and in the extremity of his dismay, cried aloud, "My God, Roman, you are here!" It is said that years of life, embittered by remorse, paid for this momentary lack of self-control. All this happened in the main quadrangle of the citadel. The warning gesture of the prince came too late. An officer of the gendarmes on guard had heard the exclamations. The incident appeared to him worth inquiring into. The investigation which followed was not very arduous because the prince, asked categorically for his real name, owned up at once. The intelligence of the Prince S being found among the prisoners was sent to St. Petersburg. His parents were already there, living in sorrow, incertitude, and apprehension. The capital of the empire was the safest place to reside in for a noble whose son had disappeared so mysteriously from home in a time of rebellion. The old people had not heard from him or of him for months. They took care not to contradict the rumours of suicide from despair circulating in the great world, which remembered the interesting love match, the charming and frank happiness brought to an end by death. But they hoped, secretly, that their son survived, and that he had been able to cross the frontier with that part of the army which had surrendered to the Prussians. The news of his captivity was a crushing blow. Directly, nothing could be done for him. But the greatness of their name, of their position, their wide relations and connections in the highest spheres, enabled his parents to act indirectly, and they moved heaven and earth, as the saying is, to save their son from the consequences of his madness, as poor Prince John did not hesitate to express himself. Great personages were approached by society leaders, high dignitaries were interviewed, powerful officials were induced to take an interest in that affair. The help of every possible secret influence was enlisted. Some private secretaries got heavy bribes. The mistress of a certain senator obtained a large sum of money. But, as I have said, in such a glaring case no direct appeal could be made and no open steps taken. All that could be done was to incline by private representation the mind of the president of the military commission to the side of clemency. He ended by being impressed by the hints and suggestions, some of them from very high quarters, which he received from St. Petersburg. And, after all, the gratitude of such great nobles as the Princess S was something worth having from a worldly point of view. He was a good Russian, but he was also a good-natured man. Moreover, the hate of Poles was not at that time a cardinal article of patriotic creed as it became some 30 years later. He felt well disposed at first sight towards the young man, bronzed, thin-faced, worn out by months of hard campaigning, the hardships of the siege and the rigours of captivity. The commission was composed of 3 officers. It sat in the citadel in a bare vaulted room behind a long black table. Some clerks occupied the 2 ends, and besides the gendarmes who brought in the prince, there was no one else there. Within those 4 sinister walls, shutting out from him all the sights and sounds of liberty, all hopes of the future, all consoling illusions, alone in the face of his enemies, erected for judges, who can tell how much love of life there was in Prince Roman? How much remained in that sense of duty revealed to him in sorrow? How much of his awakened love for his native country, that country which demands to be loved as no other country has ever been loved, with the mournful affection one bears to the unforgotten dead, and with the unextinguishable fire of a hopeless passion which only a living, breathing, warm ideal can kindle in our breasts for our pride, for our weariness, for our exaltation, for our undoing. There is something monstrous in the thought of such an exaction till it stands before us embodied in the shape of a fidelity without fear and without reproach. Nearing the supreme moment of his life, the prince could only have had the feeling that it was about to end. He answered the questions put to him clearly, concisely, with the most profound indifference. After all these tense months of action, to talk was a weariness to him. But he concealed it, lest his foes should suspect in his manner the apathy of discouragement or the numbness of a crushed spirit. The details of his conduct could have no importance one way or another. With his thoughts, these men had nothing to do. He preserved a scrupulously courteous tone. He had refused the permission to sit down. What happened at this preliminary examination is only known from the presiding officer. Pursuing the only possible course in that glaringly bad case, he tried from the first to bring to the prince's mind the line of defence he wished him to take. He absolutely framed his question so as to put the right answer in the culprit's mouth, going so far as to suggest the very words. How, distracted by excessive grief after his young wife's death, rendered irresponsible for his conduct by his despair, in a moment of blind recklessness, without realizing the highly reprehensible nature of the act, nor yet its danger and its dishonour, he went off to join the nearest rebels on a sudden impulse, and that now, penitently. But Prince Roman was silent. The military judges looked at him hopefully. In silence he reached for a pen and wrote on a sheet of paper he found under his hand, "I joined the national rising from conviction." He pushed the paper across the table. The president took it up, showed it in turn to his 2 colleagues sitting to his right and left, then, looking fixedly at Prince Roman, let it fall from his hand. And the silence remained unbroken till he spoke to the gendarmes, ordering them to remove the prisoner. Such was the written testimony of Prince Roman in the supreme moment of his life. I have heard that the princes of the S family, in all its branches, adopted the last 2 words, from conviction, for the device under the armorial bearings of their house. I don't know whether the report is true. My uncle could not tell me. He remarked only that, naturally, it was not to be seen on Prince Roman's own seal. He was condemned for life to Siberian mines. Emperor Nicholas, who always took personal cognizance of all sentences on Polish nobility, wrote with his own hand in the margin, "The authorities are severely warned to take care that this convict walks in chains like any other criminal every step of the way." It was a sentence of deferred death. Very few survived entombment in these mines for more than 3 years. Yet, as he was reported as still alive at the end of that time, he was allowed, on a petition of his parents and by way of exceptional grace, to serve as common soldier in the Caucasus. All communication with him was forbidden. He had no civil rights. For all practical purposes except that of suffering, he was a dead man. The little child he had been so careful not to wake up when he kissed her in her cot inherited all the fortune after Prince John's death. Her existence saved those immense estates from confiscation. It was 25 years before Prince Roman, stone deaf, his health broken, was permitted to return to Poland. His daughter married splendidly to a Polish-Austrian grand seigneur, and, moving in the cosmopolitan sphere of the highest European aristocracy, lived mostly abroad in Nice and Vienna. He, settling down on one of her estates, not the one with the palatial residence, but another where there was a modest little house, saw very little of her. But Prince Roman did not shut himself up as if his work was done. There was hardly anything done in the private and public life of the neighbourhood in which Prince Roman's advice and assistance were not called upon, and never in vain. It was well said that his days did not belong to himself, but to his fellow citizens, and especially he was the particular friend of all returned exiles, helping them with purse and advice, arranging their affairs, and finding them means of livelihood. I heard from my uncle many tales of his devoted activity, in which he was always guided by a simple wisdom, a high sense of honour, and the most scrupulous conception of private and public probity. He remains a living figure for me because of that meeting in the billiard room, when, in my anxiety to hear about a particularly wolfish wolf, I came in momentary contact with a man who was preeminently a man amongst all men capable of feeling deeply, of believing steadily, of loving ardently. I remember to this day the grasp of Prince Roman's bony, wrinkled hand closing on my small, inky paw, and my uncle's half-serious, half-amused way of looking down at his trespassing nephew. They moved on and forgot that little boy, but I did not move. I gazed after them, not so much disappointed as disconcerted by this prince so utterly unlike a prince in a fairy tale. They moved very slowly across the room. Before reaching the other door, the prince stopped, and I heard him, I seemed to hear him now, saying, "I wish you would write to Vienna about filling up that post. He's a most deserving fellow, and your recommendation would be decisive." My uncle's face, turned to him, expressed genuine wonder. It said, as plainly as any speech could say, "What better recommendation than a father's can be needed?" The prince was quick at reading expressions. Again he spoke with the toneless accent of a man who had not heard his own voice for years, for whom the soundless world is like an abode of silent shades. And to this day I remember the very words. "I ask you because, you see, my daughter and my son-in-law don't believe me to be a good judge of men. They think that I let myself be guided too much by mere sentiment." End of Prince Roman, 1911.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.